aga muhim zaka de kana uchus dawlat chi de.
The voice of Hamid Karzai on his inauguration day. Karzai has just been sworn in this morning as the Afghan president for his second five-year term that comes after a long election fraught with allegations of corruption. We're joined again by Anand Gopal, Wall Street Journal reporter in Kabul, where the Afghan capital has actually been on lockdown, fears of attacks on this inauguration day. Good morning again, Anand.
Thanks for having me.
Can you explain, were there any actual threats against Karzai that made them fear there could be an attack on his inauguration day?
Well, there were no specific threats against Karzai, but there was a high level of threats in general. Anytime there's been a major event like this, there's been attacks or attempted attacks. And in fact, this morning there were a few isolated incidents in various parts of the city. But for example, in the run-up to the elections, there was major attacks every single day. And there's a lot of concern that sort of thing would be repeated.
You were saying that it would be symbolically disastrous if there was to be an attack on Karzai's inauguration day. But symbolically, it can't be great for him to be going through this ceremony behind fortified walls under tight security where everyone who is interested has to watch it on a TV screen.
It certainly isn't. This is probably the better of the two bad options here. But it shows to a lot of Afghans that a lot of what's happening within the palace, the inauguration and everything associated with that is really disconnected with the reality on the ground in the city of Kabul or in the rest of the country.
And do the Afghans see this as the beginning of a new tenure for Karzai? I mean, he's promised to turn around his government and pursue corruption. Do Afghans see this as a new day or just the continuation of what they've had for the past 5 years?
They see mostly the continuation of what they've had. We've seen a lot of cynicism on the part of Afghans recently. A lot of the hope that Afghans have had in the first few years after 2001 has mostly been eroded now. And it's because politicians here have made a lot of promises. There's been a lot of people saying they want to clamp corruption and bring security, but they haven't seen that happen. So I think a lot of Afghans are taking a wait-and-see approach.
Okay, Anand Gopal joins us from Kabul. He's with the Wall Street Journal. Thanks so much. Transparency International's recent corruption index put Afghanistan as the world's second most corrupt country. Somalia's number one. That's a drop down to second. Well, actually, a lift from second from fifth place last year. The international community has been putting a huge amount of pressure on Karzai to change the corruption in his government. And here's Secretary of State Hillary Rodham Clinton this weekend.
I've made it clear that we're not going to be providing any civilian aid to Afghanistan unless we have a certification that if it goes into the Afghan government in any form, that we're going to have ministries that we can hold accountable.
The newly reelected president, Hamid Karzai, addressed corruption directly in his address, his inaugural address today. He specifically said he would find any officials in his government who were corrupt and he would prosecute them within the realms of the law. We're joined now by Isabel Coleman, senior fellow of U.S. foreign policy at the Council of Foreign Relations. Good morning, Isabel.
Good morning, Celeste.
So you heard Hillary Clinton's strong words about not offering any civilian aid to Afghanistan until corruption is handled. Is that an empty threat?
Well, I wouldn't say it's an empty threat, but it's a limited threat. I mean, the fact is that civilian aid goes along with our military engagement there, and we do already have a lot of troops in Afghanistan. We are contemplating, as everyone knows, sending more, and it would really be cutting off our nose to spite our face if we pulled out all civilian aid because we couldn't tolerate corruption in that country.
So break it down for me. There's several things that we spend money on in Afghanistan. We send a lot of money to NGOs, non-governmental organizations. We send money to the Afghan government to help them get through many of their processes and their regular day-to-day workings. And there's also the military spending, as you were saying. Can these three things be separated? Could we, for example, not send money to government offices but still fund military operations and still fund NGOs?
Yes, we could. The fact is that the overwhelming bulk of the money does go to military operations, overwhelmingly so, and that will continue. And much of that is for training the Afghan National Army and police, and we're ramping that up at a pretty big rate. In addition, you know, we give the international community provides 90% of the funds that the Afghan government spends. So we are, in effect, bankrolling the Afghan government. We, the international community, and the U.S. provides about a third of that. And we provide money to NGOs, but that's a much, much smaller number. First of all, there are not that many NGOs operating in Afghanistan. Many of them have left in recent years over security concerns. And the ones that remain have found their operations quite constrained because of concerns about security, so they're operating really just in major cities.
Do you believe Hamid Karzai when he pledges to find any corrupt officials in his government and prosecute them to the full extent of the law?
I think he's going to make some changes, and he'll pick out the low-hanging fruit. And he has made some changes already. I mean, he has switched out some ministers with U.S. pressure along the way over the last 18 months. Now the Minister of the Interior is Mohammed Atmar, who is widely recognized as a very competent and non-corrupt person. And he, as Minister of Interior, does oversee a lot of the one of the bigger Afghan budgets, because it's responsible for a lot of the road building and infrastructure that's going on. You know, will he actually take down some of the well-known drug traffickers who are in his government? I mean, there are different levels of corruption here, and he has not done that, and I'm not holding my breath that he will.
And it seems the incentives are all in the other direction, Isabel, and the certification process that Hillary Clinton describes didn't work in El Salvador during the Reagan administration. How can it work now? With Karzai so relatively powerless, it seems to me the ethnic tensions in Afghanistan force him to pay off people that he might have not had to deal with 5 years ago.
Well, that's exactly true. And the run-up to the election, you know, he brought a number of unsavory characters from the fringes back right into the center as part of his government. And that, I think, is what's fueling the previous comment about people feeling really disillusioned. So these people, you know, what campaign promises were made, we don't really know, but clearly some were to help help him get reelected. He felt he needed to make those bargains, and they would be very difficult to undo at this point.
Okay, well, it sounds like the takeaway here is that Hamid Karzai is caught between the rock of international pressure and the hard place of a culture of corruption in Afghanistan. Thanks so much. That's Isabel Coleman, Senior Fellow of U.S. Foreign Policy at the Council on Foreign Relations.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.